is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Well, you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today I'm continuing my conversation with the leading scientific expert on the World Trade Center demolition, who has degrees in civil engineering with a specialty in structural engineering, in engineering mechanics, also known as applied physics, and in materials engineering science. Her name is Judy Wood. Judy, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks. Welcome me back.
We have a couple of links here. Would you like me to start off with the 911scholarsreview.org/dirt4.html?
Yeah, I put that up hoping that folks with Internet Explorer might be able to access that.
Right. We've discovered that Internet Explorer seems to have more problems accessing Judy's pages, but that other browsers don't. So here's a link that should work for all of us. That is 911scholarsreview.org/dirt4, that's the numeral 4, .html. So try that out and see if it works for you. And if not, send a note to Judy or to me, and we'll see about giving you yet another link. Judy, would you like to give us a review of the page here? We began discussing it yesterday and got about two-thirds of the way through, but I think it would be valuable to briefly go back through it all.
Yes, I call it the Cheeto page because of that first image, which looks like a Cheeto sitting on the ground.
Right, on figure 109B to the left, it looks like a Cheeto there.
Correct. It's interesting how something could be that orange with nothing to either side of it being colored.
Yes. And now I see where some new photos you've added at the bottom make a difference. If you're accenting the color, it can make it look like this.
Yep. So as we review down, there's a story of hydraulics which shows that the upper bound of temperature is 82 degrees centigrade or 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Which, of course, is below the boiling point of water, which, of course, is a thousand degrees plus below the temperature that the steel would be if it were glowing orangish yellow.
Correct.
And if the hydraulics will cease to operate at these much lower temperatures, obviously they wouldn't be functioning at these higher temperatures, which implies that this photo has to be somehow fake.
Or manipulated in some form.
Right.
And then we talked about some excerpts from David Ray Griffin's book.
Yes.
Where it seems he puts all of his faith on testimony of folks on the government's payroll and discounts physical evidence.
And the part I was most troubled by was on page 315, where he says, "We have here an extreme example of the tendency to favor a priori arguments over empirical evidence." When he's actually talking about the director of Protec, a demolition monitoring firm, who's an expert in the area, and whose opinions about this are by no means a priori, but represent those of somebody with a massive amount of knowledge about the area. So this is a complete abuse of the term a priori. I do not know why David, who's a very philosophical person, would so misuse the term. But a priori arguments are arguments or claims whose truth or falsity can be established independently of experience. Cases I gave before would be such as arguing that freshmen are students because you define a freshman as a student in the first year of a four-year college or high school program, or that roses are flowers when roses are defined as a certain type of flower, or that Volkswagens are automobiles when a Volkswagen is defined as a kind of automobile. Contrast that with a freshman having a 4.0 grade point average, or a rose being yellow, or a Volkswagen being purple with pink polka dots. Those are all empirical sentences versus a priori ones. So this is very troublesome. It's a misuse of language here.
What I find interesting is the massive effort to deceive the public with, I call it urban legend, and sometimes it's not so urban, but it's these stories, bogus stories that are planted out there that are repeated so many times, folks think of that as fact and forget to look at the evidence.
Yeah, some of our listeners, those who were not with us yesterday, may not realize that there was a problem here in the aftermath of the destruction of the towers with what Judy he's describing is fumes, that the residue was fuming from molecular dissociation, and they had to explain it away. And in attempting to explain it away, they came up with some concocted stories about molten metal and smoke from the molten metal and so forth. And there were multiple sources here. And my suggestion would be that David appears to have been taken in by these stories. In any case, we have quite a bit of evidence that demonstrates, I think rather convincingly, that the molten metal was a myth, just as the 9/11 Commission report is a myth. So it seems to be an integral part of what is a rather broad and complex, elaborate hoax.
Psyops. 9/11 was a psyops and continues to be, and so we need to each individual ourselves ask what is making logical sense. Don't just say, well, so-and-so said something, but somebody else said something. This is acting like, prehistoric era where people didn't think. They just all, ran as a pack. But yesterday it was brought up about these people being on the payroll that he relies the most on, that turns up all the searches on Google. And the one that's probably least obvious is Leslie Robertson.
Yes.
And, a reference, and now I've added that reference and some snippets from that. It's from an article that came out in the New York Times by James Glanz, October 9th, 2001, about where this myth came from about 1.2 million tons of debris was carted away.
Oh, yes, about the vast amount of steel that was carted away. Because if, in fact, it's been turned to dust, then you can't acknowledge that the steel was not there. So you need to make up a figure that suggests, in fact, it was all carted away.
And that came from Leslie Robertson.
And that came from Leslie Robertson, where there's a case being developed here that Leslie Robertson has played a role as a duplicitous source of information that's false about 9/11. Continue.
And the statement I would like to point out is that final statement in that quote box.
Yeah.
After some rounding and some very rough figuring of 1.2 tons of the rough figure of 1.2 the debris was born.
2 million tons of debris was born. Now, is that supposed to be from the whole World Trade Center? Because we got estimating, each tower at 500. Million tons, two together would be 500,000 tons, the two together would be a million tons, and then you got an extra 176,000 tons.
Correct, and they tell you just how many tons of steel went into building the building. That's how they calculate it, is what ingredients went into building the World Trade Center.
Isn't that a wonderful argument, Judy? Now, see, that's a kind of an a priori argument in a way, because, of course, obviously what you're doing is taking what you put into it must be what you got out of it, when, in fact, that eclipses. What it does is beg the question whether everything you put into it was still there when it was after it was demolished, or rather there had to be a subtraction.
When folks state 1.2 million tons of debris was carted away, no, that's what they're told. It was carted away, and that number came from this calculation that Leslie E. Robertson and
associates. Yes. And, of course, this is the same guy who said that they didn't take into account that the planes that they designed the buildings to withstand might be loaded with jet fuel. I mean, who are they trying to kid? This is ridiculous. If you got to take into account planes, you got to take into account that they're loaded with fuel. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Judy Wood. Stand by. In any case, today I have return engagement with my special guest, Judy Wood, the leading scientific expert on the destruction of the World Trade Center. And, Judy, we're on a page, which is 911scholarsreview.org/dirt4html.
I'd like to mention something about the Vancouver conference that you just brought up. And you, in the same breath, said the most qualified person of the destruction of the World Trade Center. Why isn't she there?
I know. It's very peculiar. Plus, there's this message, very weird message, from the spokesperson for Scholars for Truth and Justice, Victoria Ashley, that reads as follows. This is dated June 20th, so this is today at 1:36 p.m. People should be aware that a DEW, Directed Energy Weapons Tribunal effort calling itself a 9/11 Citizens War Crimes Tribunal, is underway, and will be announced at the Vancouver conference. I don't think those involved are intentional disinformationists, but they are clearly focused on the idea that space weapons and nukes could have been used. If you can speak out against such efforts, please do. They are not scientific. They are claims which have not been found to have support in our movement, yet these claims are inserted into a public legal document claiming to represent our movement. It does not. Its title, the title sounds good, 9/11, International 9/11 Citizens War Crimes. And I say, who in the world does Victoria Ashley think she is to be a spokesperson for our movement? She's not a scientist. She has no qualifications to make this judgment. She's treating this as though it's a popularity contest. Truth or falsity is not a function of voting or preferences or limited imaginations. And I find it outrageous. Victoria Ashley, in my judgment, is a complete disgrace. And if you want to talk about persons who might or might not be disinformationalists, she's a prime candidate. When I first came into the 9/11 truth movement, she was the first person I spotted, based upon my experience in dealing with persons who weren't interested in the truth in relation to research on JFK, that was, in my opinion, not interested in discovering the truth about 9/11, the very first person I noticed. So I think for her to be making this kind of statement is grossly abusive, outrageous, exceeds her qualifications. Just ask this very simple question. How could she possibly know? How could she possibly know? I guarantee you she's not a student of the work of Judy Wood. And if she's not a student of the work of Judy Wood, who is the leading expert in this area, how could she possibly know? The answer is very simple. She can't. She can't possibly know. So this is outrageous and abusive, and nobody ought to take Victoria Ashley seriously. This is the same woman who has put out disgraceful press releases for Scholars for Truth and Justice that were claiming that they had had the first idea to submit these requests for clarification under the Data Quality Act, a notion that originated with Jerry Leapark, the brilliant activist attorney from Connecticut. That was equally outrageous, and in touting their own work, they were seeking to trash the submissions of Ed Haas and of Morgan Reynolds and of Judy Wood, even falsely alleging that I had made such a submission. I wish that I were in the position to do so, but I had not. The scope of the false claims being made here were blatant because those who had submitted the documents were public as a matter of record. So this person, in my opinion, is a disgrace to the 9/11 movement, and she, as a spokesperson, represents neither truth nor justice. It's very unjust. It's very untruthful. It's false and misleading to making these claims about the science of things, and it's certainly unjust not to give credit to Jerry Leapart, Ed Haas, Morgan Reynolds, and Judy Wood for their brilliant submissions under the Data Quality Act. So those are my feelings, Judy, if there's anything you'd care to add.
Well, what I want to point out is, because in there you did state it's not scientific. And let's look at, you know, the evidence. It seems that she's afraid to look at the evidence, or she's afraid for that organization to look at the evidence. Why would somebody be afraid to look at the evidence? That's what I'd like to ask.
Yeah, this is completely propagandistic. It's a totally unscientific attitude. A scientific attitude ought to be, okay, let's look at all the evidence and let's look at all the hypotheses. And this, of course, was the very point at which Steve Jones and I began to diverge after my interview with you on November 11th when I gave a couple of talks in Tucson and began to discuss the possibility that the whole causal mechanism for destroying the Twin Towers was completely different than had been previously entertained, based upon my survey of your photographic record of the massive extent and devastation that had been caused, not just to 1 and 2, but 3, 4, 5, and 6, leaving 7 to one side. Although you and I are going to return to talk about 7 more. And this is where, of course, this group, this little clique around Steve Jones sought to cast a protective cocoon around him. And they tried to subvert scholars, froze our website, stole our email list, and all these other terrible things, which were grossly unjust and certainly weren't advancing truth.
Another issue, but I would like to talk about what the data shows and the psyops of the whole 9/11 event. And
excellent.
Major psyops, and I believe this is still part of it. And from what we've seen on this page, thermite, you know, it's got some issues. And if they're going to continue with molten metal in the basement and all that business, I think what is on this page is enough to discredit that.
I think so too, Judy. Objectively and scientifically discredit it.
Yeah, and rather than, you know, this other gray area of somebody, you know, slinging mud here and there, and this journal that likes to criticize people and whatnot, just looking at the facts themselves and the evidence itself is what is so powerful. And along those lines, the other things I would like to add are it's interesting that so much attacking is going on Judy Wood. If she's speaking nonsense, why do people care?
I think that's exactly right, Judy. If you were just a crank, and they're trying to make you out to be a crank, why would anyone be paying attention? People normally don't spend a lot of time trying to attack cranks. So I suggest that it follows that you are not a crank, but rather have a highly viable and probably true hypothesis to the extent to which you've refined it.
Well, I don't really even see that it's a hypothesis so much as is data. And
yes.
What I've been doing is just laying out the data and sorting it out and thinking it through and showing people what to think about to, you know, look your way through. Think about.
I agree, because your research is really intended to clarify what in technical terms is known as the explanandum, what it is we need to explain. And you're laying out data that is highly problematical to explain on any approach that purely merely appears to conventional explosives, even if you throw in thermite and thermate. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest Judy Wood. Stand by, we'll be right back. Hey, with my special guest Judy Wood, the leading expert in the scientific issues related to the destruction of the World Trade Center. Judy, after that aside, shall we continue with a closer look at the psyops of 9/11?
Yes, and that aside was part of it, I believe, and it's always a distraction. And nobody wants you to look here. It's like a magic show. I'd like to use David Copperfield. It's a well-known name. He doesn't really pull a rabbit out of a hat. You know that because you've gone to a magic show. But if you weren't told it was a magic show and you pulled a rabbit out of a hat, would you believe it? And I think we have a lot of that going on.
Just a further aside, Judy, how can they be having a DEW conference and you not be there?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, is that they are afraid I'll bring out the facts. They're afraid to look at the evidence.
I mean, the situation is completely incoherent. That they should be focusing on the topic that you've more extensively researched than anyone else on the planet, and yet they haven't invited your presence.
Yeah, it shows how scared they are. What does that tell you? There's all these deceptive things, along the way, and that's what we were looking through. And it seems to be, you get an awful lot of clues as to what they're fighting the hardest.
Yes, I think that's right. That was the principle Jack White observed in JFK research, that the more you're attacked and the more viciously, the more likely it is you're onto the truth or something important. So if we apply that principle here, I think that the volume and viciousness of the attacks on you suggest that you're right on the money, that what you're doing is moving in a direction that those who know better don't want to pursue.
Yeah, why would my phone be getting disconnected? Why would my internet connection be dropping out? Why would everyone who sends me emails have them bounce? That's been happening the past week.
Yeah.
It's interesting coincidences, we'll call them. But what is interesting is when you start looking at the actual data, and we all were like brainwashed into looking elsewhere, because when you first see a picture, you're going to be curious as to figuring out what it is, and you're going to think for yourself.
Uh-huh.
Else introduces you to that material and tells you what the answer is, you don't think.
Uh-huh.
And so when information is presented with a story, that's the key.
Absolutely right.
And here's another thing. Folks say, how do you know who's an op and who's not or who's whatever? My answer to that is, who encourages you to think for yourself? And who discourages you from that?
Yes. Yes. What I've been doing since November 11th is simply encouraging people to consider all of the evidence encouraging them to look at what you had archived and encouraging them to think about the alternatives and not draw premature conclusions that restrict the range of possibilities when we're dealing with a very complicated, complex phenomenon.
And again, you know, my definition of directed energy weapon is energy that is directed, and it is a weapon. It isn't the conventional directed energy weapon. This is unconventional, whatever it was. I don't think any of us have seen these events before except the designers of this. But they anticipated it.
Yes.
And that's what we're seeing. And one more thing to add, the Greg Jenkins event taught me about this. I got the clues for this from that. I started looking at what he was most afraid of.
Good.
And that led me right down this path.
Very good, Judy.
And so we start looking at this. Now I'm back at a closer look at the psyops of 9/11. We have figure 137. And they're looking into, you know, this where a drop light apparently is down the ground. They're looking in there, and there's a guy in there with a shovel. And if we were shown the picture on the left first, we'd have a different impression than the one on the right. The one on the right we were shown, and the caption is, "Workers evidently peering into the hot core under the WTC rubble."
Yes.
And, you know, the guy's standing in it. And then the next pair of pictures, the first one is the original, and the second one is the one we were first introduced to.
Yes.
And thanks to Andrew Johnson, you can click and look at the presentation or even the video where it's being described. It's slide 35 in that February 1st presentation.
Really? Well, you know, I noticed that something I thought was his hat sort of floating is because there are two persons there side by side, and the one in the foreground does not have a hat on, or if he does, he's leading down, and then there's a fellow in the background who has a hat.
The one whose still hat isn't on fire.
Yeah. I mean, it would be getting tremendously hot. My God, it's going to be absorbing all that heat.
Right. So looking at figures 135 and 136, that's what I was talking about that was in the presentation. And there's links on there if you want to download the file, look at it for yourself. And it's interesting how dark that standing, it's been called the spire. It's the remaining part of the core columns.
Yes.
And those bright white specks on it. He even describes that in his presentation as being, you know, highly suggestive of thermite. He never, you know, comes out and says it. Still, you know, thermite is still just, you know, strong. He never says it's exactly that. Then we looked at that video, and I brought out some quotes from that video. It's not clear in that little text box, but more would be good. But in particular, that last quote where the woman says, "Still out on the rubble pile, it's still 1,100 degrees. The guy's boots just melt in a few hours."
Yes.
And yeah, if you put a turkey in those boots, it would be incinerated in the guy's feet. So why are they doing that? You know, this is the psyops. And that video is just packed with it from front to back, just telling you how to interpret the scene. But if we look at figure 115, we see a guy climbing down into the hole with a wet puddle down there. The pictures entered into the system the 18th of September. It could have been taken before then, but we know on that day, you know, at least by that day, it's not hot down there. But why is it so empty? If they're looking for survivors, they haven't been eating. It's
just
material. And then we talked about the difference between wet weather and dry weather. And that when it's wet, you don't have this, quote, steam coming up. I call it fumes.
Mm-hmm.
Fuming.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a picture I call the Gestapo picture.
And, of course, if there actually were all the molten metal in wet weather, there ought to be more of the steam, not less.
Where's that water going to? Water runs downhill.
In 112.
Yeah, water goes downhill. It goes down into the basement or wherever it's going. And we're, you know, so it should encounter the molten metal at some point, or something hot.
And, of course, there's enough moisture in the air that we're getting this rainbow.
Yeah. Oh, this next picture with the rainbow, that's they're hosing down the pile. But it's interesting that the pile, and you can especially see it on the picture on the right, where's the dirt from? To begin with, why? Here you are in the footprint of the building, and you have the saturated dirt, mountains of dirt, lots of dirt. And it's saturated, and it's so saturated that it's running off and into the puddle, collecting in the puddle. And why would you have steam coming out of that wet dirt? Where's the fire?
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest today, Judy Wood. Stand by. We'll be right back. My special guest today is Judy Wood, the most highly qualified scientist studying the destruction of the World Trade Center. Judy, please continue.
Thanks. So we're just about caught up to where we were yesterday.
Yes.
Figure 110, I call that the Gestapo picture. It looks like there's an officer overlooking this woman with a child.
Uh-huh.
Up on the hill, but what is so striking about this is the footprint of one of the towers, I believe Tower 1, and it's filled with dirt. When they made the bathtub, they went down to bedrock and put, you know, this concrete all the way around. There's no reason you should have it filled with dirt.
Oh, that's a wonderful observation. It should be concrete, that's right, not dirt. And when we see it all cleared out, it is nothing but concrete, and it's very spiffy and very clean.
Right. That's how it was built, and then you have the parking garages. You have everything man-made and built in there, including the plaza level with the fountain.
Now, with the rainbow, Judy, in the background, would that require water or just some kind of, you know, the kind of fuming? Would the fuming be sufficient to sustain a rainbow, or would it require mist?
If you click on that, on the source file, you go to the original.
Yeah.
And it's a huge picture, but you will see where the water's coming from. It's a fire hose. It's just clamped up there. It's hosing it down. Nobody's even manning the hose. It's
all. Got it. So that's the source of the water there. Very good. That is a huge picture.
Yeah, and so that's why I cut out various portions of it.
Well, that's very good for everyone to notice that, you know, there is mist in the picture in the rainbow because there's a source, a water source that's being poured on it.
Yeah, but there's so much water that's been poured on it, the dirt is completely saturated.
Yes.
It's leaching out into that pool at the bottom.
Yes, and again, if there were these masses of molten metal putting all that water there, ought to be precipitating steam explosions.
Yeah, the dirt is completely saturated. That's why you have a puddle.
Yeah, very good, very good.
Yeah, water also goes downhill, and so below that dirt is just, you know, it's wet.
Very good.
And the picture on the left, you see those bright, bright red rust parts of the core column.
Yes.
And that rust is amazing, and that's the end of October. You'll say, okay, you know. now, if we go to the next picture, that's what I say, if that was hot, if it were really hot, those guys would look more like pieces of a grilled cheese sandwich.
The orangish stuff, if that actually represented the heat.
Yeah. They're working on something. Looks like they have a cutting torch, and they're doing something out there.
Uh-huh.
If that, everybody steam clams, shrimp, you steam things, and it cooks it. And so if this is steam coming out, those guys would be cooked.
Yes. If that were super hot steam, right. I mean, it's as I've observed, you know, would you put your face over the spout of a tea kettle when it starts to whistle? Of course you wouldn't. You'd be scalded. These guys would be being scalded.
So when this is said to be, you know, steam coming off of the metal, it's, you know, it's kind of silly.
Yeah, nice point.
Explanation for this. And then the next picture down is figure 114.
Right.
On it, you'll notice on the left side of the picture, there's a beam there in the ground, and it's unbelievably rusty.
Uh-huh.
Orange rust.
Yes.
Uniform coloring. So it
yes.
Didn't rust over, you know, this piece here. It's something happened to it to cause it to rust, as well as all the other debris over in that area.
Yes.
And again, you see those cranes operating over there, so you know that it's not too hot. And the other picture, 115, that's where you have a lot of these grapplers out on that pile. In order for them to drive out to there, if it was really hot, they would have been ruined before they got there. So we know.
Yes.
Now, so what is that? That stuff that looks like steam. I call it fumes. Fumes from the building.
Yes.
And building fumes. And the next picture down, fuming rust.
Spectacular.
You see the material turning to rust instantly. You know,
in the right foreground.
Yeah, and also the other pieces in the foreground are extremely rusty.
Yes.
Steel does not rust that quickly.
Yes. Well, that's another reason it's used in construction.
Right, and iron does. So how does the steel turn to iron? That is the key evidence there. Steel was turned to iron.
You'd have to get rid of the carbon.
And the other, like, doodad ingredients in there.
Yeah.
So how do you do that while the piece is still solid?
But
it's on the surface. Now we go to this picture 117 of the Pepsi truck.
Yes.
If you click on it, you get a blown-up picture of it, and you'll notice that it's missing paint in the front in some areas. Some areas rusted and some did not. And all the rust is the same color and probably happened at the exact same time. Something was attacking the steel and turning it into iron, unprotected iron.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing. There's a little audio clip there of part of the song that Ace Baker wrote.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you want to play it.
Sure, let's see if we can catch it here.
Just the first one, the first link, where it says office fires can't do that.
Well, indicating streaming MP3.
Yeah, the office fires can't do that, that part. No, don't go to his site. Just the office fires can't do that. That it's just a short segment.
Oh, office fires can't do that. Okay, got it. Got it.
I mean, if they're going to say office fires did this, my gosh. Office fires don't do that.
Yes.
That phrase is so powerful. It's like, so go to the next picture down, 118.
Yes.
This is shortly after 9/11 because you see the flowers up on top. They put flowers on vehicles, I think, where people were killed or maybe because the vehicle was affected. But all around, I've studied the toasted car issue. I've got thousands of pictures of these toasted cars.
Right.
And I've noticed that these flowers got put on about the next day. This is a FEMA picture. They entered it into the system on the 13th, which was the first day they entered any pictures. So it could have been taken the day before, I believe it was. And I have three pictures now of this fire truck. And we notice the pile in the background. You know, there's lots of people around, so, you know, they've gone to work. But notice how much rust is on those beams sticking up. And more importantly, there's something, you'll see more of it later. The guy in the foreground on the left, to the left of his hat, you see a white bucket on top of the fire truck. And you see right in front of it a spool of rusty something.
This is on number 75.
No, figure 118. But you see it more later. Maybe it's easier to see it in the other ones and go back and look for it. So, looking at 293, there's not much rust. And then in 75, there's lots of rust. You click on that picture, you see that fire truck has unbelievable rust for in the next days right after 9/11. How does that fire truck rust that fast?
Yes.
That's that figure 75.
Yes.
I believe that's the 13th. The one on the left.
It's the 13th. Well, yes.
The one on the left, it hasn't rained yet. And the first big rain was on the 14th, so that has to be before that date because we have white powder on the wheat checks there.
Look at that fascinating bent beam in the background there, Judy. That's one of the major support beams, and look how it's bent.
Which one?
In the back of 293. That's not a grappler. That's a bent beam from a central core column, is it not?
That orange one is a grappler thing. It's a bigger.
Oh, it is a grappler?
Yeah, that orange thing.
Oh, I see. Okay, I opened it up. Yeah, I see.
Yeah, actually, there's very few beams that are bent. They kind of look like pickup sticks. But what is impressive is, you know, figure 75 is how much rust there was so quickly.
It's all over the place.
And it's the same color rust. Same
yes.
Color.
Yes. Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Judy Wood. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood, the leading scientist studying the World Trade Center destruction. And we're on a page of her website, which can be found at 911scholarsreview.org/dirt4. That's the numeral 4.html. Judy, we're down to figure 121, which looks very impressive.
First, 119.
Okay, the grappler again.
Yeah, if we looked at the rusted fire truck, you know, that's an impressive amount of rust, like within a day or two of 9/11.
Oh, you're in 293.
And 293 and 75.
Right.
And that's an amazing amount of rust. So now we see this grappler picture. And we see this bent thing in the ground, and I call it Cheeto.
The original Cheeto shot, yeah.
And you see this orange stuff. And we've seen a lot of orange stuff on the scene. Ah, could we find a way to hide the orange stuff? You know, okay, now we move on to the next section, rusty beams and pipe.
A lot of Cheetos there.
Those look like the original Cheetos.
Sure do.
And this is the original picture, and it's, well, this is a shrunken down version of it, but I've got the link to the original if you want to get a huge picture of it. You see the pipes, like, over on the right-hand side about, halfway down the picture. You see a horizontal pipe that has bright orange or black, or bright orange or black. It's like, why was it hit in some places and not others?
Looks a lot like a snake.
And the two on the left, in the upper left corner, or three there. Those are Cheetos.
They were hit all the way.
Just of what's sticking out, the one that you see towards the middle of the picture looks like it isn't hit down where it's tucked in.
Does this imply the possibility of a kind of masking that you get the orange-black?
I think this is a real event. I think there's just an amazing amount of rust from something that got to it, something that hit it. Like, you know, let's say you have the dust cloud that rolls over it, and wherever the dust cloud flowed, you end up with this tremendous rust. So this picture would be easy to tweak to make it look molten or whatever, make it glow. And below that picture, I cut out the upper left quadrant.
Uh-huh.
Side. I tweaked it. Everything in the picture of that color, I accentuated.
Uh-huh.
And you can see all these little specks all around the picture of where the rust stands out.
I guess that's the thermite, Judy.
Yep, the thermite, those specks. When you have a fire in your fireplace and the fire goes out and you turn out the lights at night, you see some glowing embers. It's usually in a core of where the hottest place was. You don't have a glowing ember over here and then over there and up here and over yonder. But when you do this tweaking with a picture, you end up with that effect.
Mm-hmm.
A little bright speck here and there. But, this amazing amount of rust. And you could do anything with photoshopping of color alterations. But I think what this exercise was is to train us what to see when we did see these pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, that must be glowing molten metal.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's look at the rusty cars. Under FDR Drive is this police car number 2723. And on the right-hand side, you see an interior shot of the car. There are no, inside door fixtures, no handles, no upholstery. And look at the back of behind the seats. Where it used to be the seats. It's all rust. Why would it rust that fast inside the car?
Just the next day.
Yeah, or within a day or so, how long would it, you know, you're going to leave this thing around? But something can't rust that fast on the inside. I'm going to add to this page some pictures of cars that have been on fire. And there's usually, you know, some stuffing from the seats left. And then you have a toasted door panel, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, this is like every single fitting is missing. Door handles are missing.
Mm-hmm.
Armrest, it's bizarre. And the rust. And the picture right below that, number 126.
Yes.
It is awesome. If you click on that one, make it, well, it doesn't get much bigger. That, you know, that's amazing rust, and they are going to leave that on the street for very long. And it's stacked on top of this other car that is not rusty, or not nearly rusty like that.
Uh-huh.
And look at the way these people are looking at it. They're saying, oh, my gosh, what on earth caused all that rust? A car to be that...
Not just the rust, but, look, the whole thing is so mangled.
You can argue about the mangling business as, you know, if something landed on it. It looks like it's a bouquet of flowers on it, so that would mean this is, like, within a day or two.
Okay.
And then we come down, we have more rusty cars, more rusty, you know, this amazing rust. How long does it take to rust those cars? And even that toasted lot that's diagonally across from Building 6, we have this whole parking lot with, you know, rusty cars in it. Why would cars being on fire cause them to rust instantly? I've got pictures now, I haven't uploaded them yet, of cars that have been on fire and they don't have rust on them afterwards. For weeks. They, you know, long time. And continue on down the page to 133 and 134. 133, you see those pieces drooped over. We're looking at Building 2. And on the left is that stub remaining from Building 3. And what's hanging off of it is very rusty, all the uniform color. And if, we won't do it now, but if someone wanted to, you can look at the large picture. And up above the flag on the left there, the ends of those wheat checks, extremely rusty. How could something rust that fast, that much? And 134, you have all of these grapplers pushing dirt around. I don't see them loading up any truck. They're just pushing dirt around, and they're obviously not over a hotbed. How many diggers do you have out there? they're not getting toasted.
I see at least five grapplers, maybe six.
Yeah, and there's the dirt.
Seven even.
The dirt pile gets bigger. It gets more packed in as time goes on in that area, which is interesting. You know, what are they doing? If they're loading up something, where's the truck they're loading it into? They're pushing dirt around. And
they had to know what they were doing in some sense or other, don't you think, Judy, that they, I mean, they had to have directions about where to put the dirt. And presumably some explanation of why dirt was needed.
Oh, you have this fire that you have to put out.
Okay.
That's probably being told. But if there's a fire, then why isn't the grappler getting cooked?
If there's a fire of the kind they're describing, the molten metal.
Right, and also the guy who's sitting in the cab of those things, you know, he'd be cooked too if it was that hot.
Is this can this be thermite over on the left on 133 that's causing those sparks?
They're doing something. They've got a cutting torch up there, and they're working on something.
Oh, yeah, I'm opening it up.
Yeah, they're...
It looks like there probably is a torch.
Yeah, they're doing something there.
Okay.
But the rust in that picture is just pretty awesome, especially above the flag on the left, into those columns. And I added some excerpts from an article, and this is a source if you want to read the whole thing, about how the Iraq War...
How the war was sold. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. We're continuing a conversation with my special guest, Judy Wood, the leading scientist studying the 9/11 with regard to the devastation of the World Trade Center. Judy, did you want me to read this piece from Jeffrey St. Clair on how to sell a war?
No, but I encourage folks to read it, and there's several interesting things in there. It shows that it has nothing to do with right and wrong. It's what they can sell.
That's right. It has to do with psychology and nothing to do with logic. It has to do with manipulation and nothing to do with facts. It has to do with spin control and nothing to do with evidence. This is really quite a very nice, incisive characterization of how the war was marketed.
And, you know, if the war was marketed, you know 9/11 was marketed.
Yes. And yes, I think that's quite right.
What jumped out at me is this bottom two paragraphs about the large paragraphs that they talk about the Jessica Lynch story.
Right, when the Pentagon needed an heroic story, they dredged one up.
Now,
and the fact that it was completely false or it had nothing to do with reality, as this courageous young woman has pointed out, couldn't inhibit them. I mean, it served its purpose for a week. It distracted the public and gave them this image of this young heroine.
Right. Do you see any parallels with the Todd Beamer story with Let's Roll?
Absolutely, absolutely. All the malarkey of Flight 93.
Right, and it gives people a focus of heroism. And
now, this looks to me like, in the Philip Zelikow School of Communication, where he, of course, is an expert in the creation and maintenance of political myths.
Yeah, that's probably right on. So hopefully we have time now. We can go directly to the WTC7 page.
Yes, yes.
The last two pictures on this page are interesting. I show one where a lightning bolt is hitting the building one.
The tower on the north tower.
The TV antenna.
Right.
You know that thing was built to take a lot. It was well grounded.
Yes.
Hey, but the second picture is one that has struck up an emotional response for me. Why weren't these people warned? Why weren't their office mates warned? You know, how dare somebody do this to these people? If you want to destroy the towers, tell people not to come into work that day.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. If you had any compassion, these people are sadistic. They're cruel. They're greedy. They're ruthless.
That's what this picture does for me. Okay.
Remember, Henry Kissinger described Donald Rumsfeld as the most ruthless person he'd ever known. And Kissinger, of course, was not exactly Casper Milquetoast. Okay, we're going to a new page now. Here it is, 911scholarsreview.org/WTC7.html. I repeat that, 911scholarsreview.org/WTC7.html. 911scholarsreview.org/WTC7. numeral7.html, going there now.
And if you're on the other page, you might be able to click on that link, but okay, the bottom. So we're on that new page, I just threw up there. It's not, well organized yet, but these are the issues. For those who aren't familiar with the layout of the land, that first picture shows where Building 7 is relative to the towers.
Right. If you stop at the bottom, you got the south tower above it with the antenna we just saw struck by lightning as the north tower, and directly to the right, as though the corner of the tower pointing at it, is Building 7.
Correct. And look how tiny those other buildings are.
Yes.
Remember how Building 6 seemed huge compared to the rubble left from Tower 1?
And 6 is in between the north tower with the antenna and Building 7 right there. It's partially hidden by Building 1. And then you have Building 5 just below it.
In the corner, yeah.
And then you have 4 straight out from that protrusion. And 3 is on the other side of the south tower there, actually.
Right, you see a little thingy in there.
Yeah.
Now we're looking at it. So once upon a time, there was a building called WTC7. Then it went away. Poof.
Then it went away.
It didn't even spill onto the adjacent streets or much.
Well, Astonishing 89 is a great picture.
And there's a large amount of it below that. There's 86A and 89 I put side by side. Look at, in 89, you can click on it and make it big. You look down in there in the alley, or the street down below.
Pretty tiny.
Yeah, and you realize this stuff didn't even spill out more than a lane or so out there. It didn't, the spillage didn't reach the postal building, which is on the right.
I continue to say that the Building 7 has to be one of the most robust buildings ever construction in the history of civil engineering.
The straddle that
those electrical generators, yeah.
And if you look on the left side of it, you see it just a narrow street, like a couple lanes wide.
Uh-huh.
How could that building drop down there without spilling into much into the street?
Uh-huh.
And it not damaging the postal building at all, not even touching it.
As we can see in figure 86B.
Yeah, you could drive a scooter around the thing. This is after a few days, but you could drive that. By the next day, you could drive a Jeep around the perimeter.
Pretty nice piece of work.
Amazing piece of work.
Amazing piece of work.
And figure 202 is looking down West Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
South, and just beyond that bus is where WTC 7 should be. What's interesting is notice that bus is kind of pooched out on the top, on the left and right side. You see it way down there?
Yes.
And then on the right, it's not so pooched out there anymore. I don't know what, was that the plastic billboard signs on it that were expanded like balloons or what?
I don't know, that is curious.
But also notice that car in the foreground. No headlights or no fittings on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one particular kind of material just was disintegrated. Like the bus, you still have the structure of the bus, but you're missing, the covering on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the frame. But where the bus is sitting, beyond that is Building 7. Right past that intersection on the right is Building 7.
Yeah, straight down the street. Well.
And look how wide that street is. It's not very wide. And then we notice in 244, this is the next day, you see that maybe it's the 13th, I'm not sure. It's either the 12th or 13th. Look how scrubbed down the streets are already. But look at the Building 7 didn't even spill over onto the postal building, which is on the left here.
Mm-hmm.
It's, how could a building 47 stories tall end up not spilling to the left or to the right?
Pretty neat pile of debris.
243 shows that, too.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Continuing my conversation with Judy Wood, the leading scientist investigating the World Trade Center and the devastation brought about there. Right now we're talking about Building 7, and Judy has a new webpage. You can find it 911scholarsreview.org/WTCinCaps7.html. Judy, we're around figure 244 and 243 with the pile of debris, which is about, I don't know, five stories high, I would say, from that 47-story building, maybe more.
Yeah, it looks like it's not much, though. It's definitely more than the towers left.
Which is astonishing, since at 47 stories, it's less than half the height of the 110-story World Trade Center towers.
But still, it's not normal. It looks like we have a facade covering a pile of sawdust.
Uh-huh. Looking at 250, for example.
Yeah, I was getting down into it. Yeah, 250, that's a picture from the next street over from what we're looking at above, from the other side. What struck me about this is that on the far right-hand side of the picture is a guy in the base of a building that has a blue suit on.
Yeah.
A bunch of dirt. Look at all that dirt over there. It's a huge pile of dirt. Now, what are they doing with dirt here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should add to this a picture, a little video clip of the WTC-7 going poof. And to me, it always looked like it was pushed over the edge of a cliff and it just dropped free fall, the top part. You don't see the bottom part. You see
not pushed over, but dropped over, just let go.
Is though it got dropped over the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, it's just because it's so much in free fall.
Yeah, and yes. I wondered, what happens if you can have some kind of a magical way of eating up the bottom of the building as soon as it falls into that space?
Okay.
Then you could do that. So So let's, you know, think about that. If you do that, then you have just the top, a little bit of facade flopping down on top of this pile of...
So like if it were going into a gigantic vat of acid.
Right. Yeah, that's a good analogy. And we're just noticing what we see. We're not saying we know how it was done. We're just saying what we see. And that's what we see. But we also see dirt all over the place. And dirt is what you use for chemical spills. And like as we saw that dirt in the base of towers, you know, where do you get this dirt from? Right after the event. So you got a bunch of dirt there. Now we go down to the next picture, 261. And you can see the fumes coming off of the pile of Building 7, or the fumes coming off of the pile of whatever it is, Building 1. I can't really call it a pile, but the remains of 1, as well as 6. 1, 6, and 7 we see in this picture, and we see this, what looks like steam, but I'm going to call it fumes, coming up. And notice how the Verizon building is hosing down the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no steam where it's hosing it down. Doesn't it look peculiar?
Yes.
Make it wet and there's no steam that comes up.
Yes. You think the more water, the more steam.
Right.
Here, the more water, the less.
Yep. And that's why they put wet dirt on it. And soak down the dirt to keep it wet. Like a wet blanket. As we come down, I got some maps there if someone wants to get reoriented. Where we are. And the next picture is unbelievable. 84?
Yeah.
It looks like a Dagwood sandwich. Does it look like, a sawdust pile with the outer facade laying on top of it? That's dirt.
Yeah, fascinating.
This is looking out the window of one of the buildings. I'm guessing it is out of the Verizon building, but that's just a bunch of dirt there. And then next picture is down, 85 and 87. It's dirt, lots of dirt. How do you get more and more dirt ending up there? Where's it coming from?
And most importantly, why?
Bingo. And, it's covered with mud. And still you have the steam coming out of it. It looks like steam. It's still fuming. Picture 87?
Yeah.
It's still fuming. It's got this wet dirt on it. And then we come down to 88. And, with time, the pile gets taller.
Yeah.
You know,
it's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. You get all the dirt. It's just like, the pictures from West Street of Building 3, you got more and more dirt. You know that picture with the 5 grapplers? They're, wake up. The pile of debris here, why would it be taller? Why would it be getting filled more and more with debris? I'm wondering if they use a pressure hose to hose it down. The next picture, 86, is from the backside showing more dirt. And still you have this, fumes coming out of the dirt. Now we're going to get into this big drum roll. This is what is going to be on page 5. I may have to move the page numbers around, dirt 5. But I haven't gotten to that yet. But this yellow bordered picture, it says WTC2.
Yeah.
Click on it, and it'll enlarge.
I don't actually have, okay. When I clicked on it, it did enlarge. This is an Amin Zafar photograph.
Right. Now, what is interesting, both towers are there.
Right.
Look at the mechanical floor of Tower 1. You have a fuzzy blob coming out of it. Embryonic stem cell research destroys human
life. If this legislation became law, it would... The mechanical floor, you mean down there at the, with the top of the first section of the three sections of the building?
Right. Sometimes they call it the seam.
So it's below the dome to the left, about 10 floors, maybe 7 floors to the right are there.
Yeah.
I see it.
There's a fuzzy blob there.
Yep.
Why is that coming out of the mechanical floor? And later you'll see them coming out of the other mechanical floors. But the most striking thing about this picture is nothing has gone poof yet. Nothing has been destroyed. why is southern Manhattan fuming? Look to the right.
Yeah.
There's haze.
That's pretty weird. There is all that haze, Judy. That is pretty weird. I mean, I've seen his photos. Most of them, of course, are completely clear. This is very funny.
There are several pictures like this if it shows southern Manhattan, but it starts building up in the fumes. And in Rick Siegel's video, he captured that, how, you know, from the, he was further north of here. But it looked like, you know, when they talk about explosions in the basement, the cover story, I believe, for the fuming that was coming up. There's a whole bunch of fuming around. And you can look at Building 3 down in there. You can see the little guy down there. It's below that mechanical floor, straight down, and you see fumes coming out of it.
Hmm.
Now, what do you think these fumes are about?
Great question.
And then 443, we'll go to that picture and click on that one and enlarge it. This is another phenomenon I'm calling silly string. It looks like silly string got squirted.
Yeah, I see it.
And that's out of the mechanical floor, the upper mechanical floor.
Yeah, it is.
And notice on the right, you see Tower 2 starting to get fuzzy, furry. I might have a new term, furry. It starts getting, you know, coming up. And go to 444, that picture, and click on it, make it larger. And you'll see this is another phenomenon I'm naming as smoke rings.
What are you going to call this? What's the name for this, Judy?
Rings.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Judy Wood, and we're concluding our conversation today, but I look forward to having her back. We're at figure 144, Judy. And as I understand it, you're talking about this phenomenon as smoke rings.
Yeah.
Because they're on the side of the South Tower, you can see something that sort of looks like a large smoke ring or two.
Yeah, figure 444, if you click on it, you get an enlargement.
Right.
And on the right side of Tower 1, you see some shooting out up above. And on the South Tower, on the left side, you see them coming out of various windows.
You know, this is capturing the explosion as it's just taking place there on the North Tower, I think.
How do you know it's explosions?
Well, I was presuming, you know, because you can see the sort of the whole floor is sort of massively erupting. This, if I take it right in terms of the footage of the collapse, I would say this is just the initiation point.
What collapse?
Oh, yeah. Of the very top, you know, just from that very top part. Of course, I know the whole building is actually going to be pulverized, but...
Who went first?
Pardon me?
Building 2 went away first.
Oh, yeah, that's right, of course. So what am I thinking about? Right, absolutely right. Nice point, okay.
You have the same phenomenon in both buildings.
Uh-huh.
More advanced in the second building.
Yeah.
Tower 2 looks kind of furry. It has these little...
It does, all fuzzy.
Yeah, it's got these little squirming things, and that's not an explosion. Explosion is, you know, a one-time event.
Uh-huh.
It's why I call it smoke rings is because it's segmented. It's intermittent. The things come out and they're kind of like silly string, black silly string.
Is there a manual?
And it's pretty interesting how the building suddenly gets furry just before it goes poof.
It is. Now I'm looking at figure 10.
Look at 19. Well,
okay.
19 is, and click on that one. That's a beautiful picture of the smoke rings from Tower 1. On the right-hand side, see how it's so segmented? That's not a natural smoke event. There's some phenomenon going on there. And if you look above...
You're talking about 10 or 20 floors down on the right?
Yeah, and you see that bright orange thing, orange floor all across?
Yeah.
It's not smoking. You know, how can it be on fire if it's not smoking? It's just glowing.
Yeah, that's the part I was looking at before, mistakenly.
It's pretty weird. And where that bright spot is in the upper right corner, the smoke, what appears to be smoke coming out of there, look how segmented it is on the lower side. It almost looks like a colon, kind of, how segmented it is. That's not a natural smoke cloud. And then the smoke rings further down that come out segment, the reason why I call them smoke rings, cigarette smoke rings, scented. There's things, and that's what this looks like, separated things. Now we'll look at figure 10. Click on that. That is a magnificent photo.
Rather stunning.
What is going on? You know, I've mentioned the two-tone color that I noticed.
Yes.
Here we see the two-tone color.
Light up to the top 10 or so floors, and then all of a sudden you get all that dark. That's going to be the 96, so it'll be the top 15 floors.
Not this. Let's not count how many floors are doing what. Let's look at the phenomenon. You've got these whitish kind of clouds shooting out from what appears to be every single window or part of the building, but it's not continuous. It's just like out of every single floor.
Yes.
This is not a cloud rolling up. It appears that they cranked up the knob for this effect. I call this lathering up.
Mm-hmm.
Soap says lathering up. It lathers up the building, waiting for its demise.
Mm-hmm.
It softens up the building. And if you want to get a really big picture, click on the source link underneath Figure 10. And, whoops, no, they took that. They took it down. It was up earlier today, but they took it down.
yeah. Okay.
But anyway, it is very interesting phenomenon. And I have a sequence of these where it appears that, you know, once the clouds finish rolling out from Tower 2, then they crank back the knob because it's too obvious. But we know this isn't clouds rolling up the side from the rollout of Tower 2 because the smoke at the top is still going horizontally.
And then when I look at Building 7 and 89E, we see those clouds on the side of the building.
Right. It's lathering up. Lathering up for its demise, coming out of every single orifice out of that building, every single window.
So this is part of why you think, even though it looks like a classic controlled demolition, it probably isn't.
I thought it was done by a beam weapon thing before, but I couldn't figure out how to get into the bottom.
Yeah.
But now what I'm beginning to think it is a two-stage thing. The building gets softened up ahead of time by maybe some gas or something like that. That's speculation, but some process, some chemical process that is then initiated by a beam of some sort or by some other step. Like photographic film. You have photographic emulsion, which, you know, why do you keep photographic film in the freezer? Because there's a chemical reaction taking place, even though it's slow. But once exposed to light, it's very quick. So visible light energy hitting that photographic film causes that chemical reaction to accelerate, where it can kind of keep going on its own if you didn't expose it. Like if you keep it in a hot car, your photographic film goes bad. Let's look at it, you know, various other processes like that. You get, you know, two different things. So think of the beam as an activator. And so you can that way control what you're demolishing. So let's say Building 6 that they filled with this gas or whatever it was. And then when the beam hits the building, it causes the building to disintegrate. But
building 6, did you say?
Yeah, you know the one with the nice holes in it?
Uh-huh.
Now, also Liberty Street. Let's say some of this this lathering up poured out over onto Liberty Street. If a beam hit Liberty Street, there you go with a hole. If the lathering up hadn't poured onto Liberty Street, maybe Liberty Street wouldn't have a hole in it. So it's like a two-part kind of thing. It's maybe even more parts to it. So something that starts activating, and then it gets accelerated by this other energy source, the beam. The beam, I believe, is what controls it, is the directed part of it. But it's clear that they've, lathered up the building.
Fascinating.
And all the dirt being brought in is consistent with a chemical process. I've got more evidence, too, but there's only so much I can do at one time. Evidence that it is indeed a chemical process. I have a picture of a video of a guy walking down the street, and the cars are igniting next to him. In other words, the cloud didn't ignite the cars. The cloud just infected the cars. That's what it appears. And then they start, like, you know, disintegrating. But what I think happened is, Tower 2 was difficult because it would look weird if they lathered it up. People would notice. So they had to do this other business. And then, while Tower 2 was going poof and the dust cloud was flowing outward, then they cranked up the knob on the lathering up of Tower 1. And Tower 1 was all lathered up, and then it was ready to just disintegrate. Tower 1 was a much better job, and now I think I know why.
Judy, we're going to have to come back and discuss all this again. I can't thank you enough for the time and effort you're devoting to this. Your website is simply marvelous. I want to encourage everyone to go to drjudywood.com and keep up with her work. We'll have Judy back. Thank you so very much. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you for listening.